It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Lib Dem councillor for Henleys, Claire Campion-Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, is the White Horse Czech sexual abuse inquiry chair Fiona Wolf still in her job tonight? The systematic abuse at the highest levels, an uncomfortable taboo, is it? Which connects Britain and the United States. The Franklin cover-up was thoroughly investigated by Yorkshire TV in the 1990s, but the documentary was never shown. We hear a clip from it tonight. And 3 years after the assassination of Libya's Colonel Gaddafi, we continue this week from last week. And he was assassinated by a mob. We take a look back at the terror attack the British and American governments blamed on Libya. And we hear from the father of one of the passengers at Lockerbie, Pan Am Flight 103, that perished. Plus, the Israelis close off Temple Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque. What's the latest from this well-known religious flashpoint in the heart of Jerusalem? And rule by banksters. Is it that simple? I suppose you'd call it a plutocracy, rule by the rich. One man, Aaron Russo, he's stood to be governor of Nevada, thinks it is. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, the fires of hell seem to be well stoked today, don't they? Mild tonight, minimum of 13 degrees Celsius. This weekend, mild 14, and dry and sunny periods tomorrow, that's Saturday, but rainy on Sunday. Next week, around 11 degrees Celsius, still relatively warm, clear skies until Wednesday. Raining again on Thursday and Friday, though. Next weekend, that's the 8th and 9th of November, down to 8 Celsius. Weekend is looking clear and cold until Wednesday or Thursday, week after next, when it's going to be rainy and cloudy again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Henleys, Claire Campion-Smith. Hi, Claire, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much indeed, and hello.
Could you give us an idea of what got you into politics, Claire, and how long you've been in the job?
Well, I really got into politics because of my husband, actually. So I've been a member of the Liberal Party and then the Liberal Democrats for a long time. And then when I retired from teaching, it just so happened that the councillor in the ward wanted to stand down. And so I decided that I would try and be elected as a councillor. I'm extremely glad that I did do it because I do think it's a very fascinating job, and I think it's a very privileged job because you have access to parts of the city that otherwise you wouldn't know as a normal citizen.
So what is that? Is that like the mayor's secret bunker?
No. The mayor is very recent in many ways. No, I suppose I'm thinking about the fact that, especially when I was the lead for children's services, how I was able to visit different parts of the city, find out how they were addressing the needs of children and families, and also having people talk with great passion about the work that they do. We have an awful lot of really committed people within the city who are completely dedicated to helping children.
Now, there's a lot of criticism, particularly of the changes that have happened since this coalition government, which Liberal Democrats are part, came in, particularly the acceleration of things like academy schools, free schools. As an ex-teacher yourself, what are your thoughts on all that, Claire?
I hope we've reached a stage where, in a sense, there will be no more changes. As a party, we did pass a motion expressing concerns about free schools and academies. I think that as a party we worked extremely hard to try and make sure that there was equality of funding between the two. I actually think that the self-improvement system that is coming in is a very powerful way of making schools improve. And it is about joint working. So that's good. I'm very, very proud about the fact that we have put in the pupil premium, because that is certainly enabling children who come from a more disadvantaged background to make a lot of progress.
Well, this
in
is the main problem, isn't it, in education? I think you might agree, I don't know, but that children that come from poorer areas generally tend to have less choice over which schools they go to.
And, yes.
And that the parents are often living in a specific area which is wealthy, and there's a good school there. And there are kind of sink schools which a lot of parents would rather their kids didn't go to, but they're in the poorer areas. So how are we addressing that?
Yes, okay. I think when we look at our Bristol schools, we've now reached a stage where we've got over 80% of primary schools that are good or outstanding. Now, that is really good. I don't think that there are sink schools nowadays, but I do think that every school has always got to be alert to when they're not addressing the needs of the pupils. So there can never be any particular complacency about it. But what we are finding is that where schools work together in small groups, where they support and challenge each other, then they do make a journey of improvement for the young people.
Okay, what committees and things are you on the City Council? Because I just want to try and get to understand the changes that you've seen since the mayor system came in, because many councillors say, well, actually our job is far less important than it was. Really, the mayor just makes all the decisions.
Yes, and this is a difficulty, and I think we have to be honest and say that we are still trying to find our way around that. I do sit on the People Scrutiny Commission. Now, there's an awful lot that happens in Bristol that is not the direct responsibility of the mayor. So, in fact, we work with our partners, with schools, with health, with the police and so on. So quite a lot of the scrutiny work will be connected with those sort of bodies and testing to a large extent how national policies are actually carried out in Bristol. I'm also on the Business Change and Resources Scrutiny Commission. And that, I think, has probably got a very powerful work to be done in looking at the budget and looking at how the resources are being used.
So in these commissions, who are you scrutinising?
Well, we are scrutinising the mayor.
So does he turn up to scrutiny? Because we were hearing last week that
yes.
One quite important scrutiny committee that Chris Brown attended from Bristol 24/7 news website, the mayor just wasn't there.
It is very difficult, or it has been difficult, to get the mayor there. And I think this has been one of the problems, that actually he has seen scrutiny as being criticism, whereas it isn't necessarily. It is a question of testing and challenging where we feel that there are drawbacks, but there's also policy development, which is very important. But actually, a lot of the decisions also made by officers, and officers do attend. And I have to say that the current bunch of officers, for instance, for the People Scrutiny and the Business Scrutiny, are very willing to come to debate.
Well, I should think so too. I mean, that's what you're there to do, is to scrutinise what they're up to. Nice
yes.
to hear they're willing to come along.
Yeah. But they come along and they see a purpose in it. So I'm not just saying that they come along in a passive sort of way, but they see a purpose in it, in involving councillors. Because, of course, councillors are out there in their community. We're the ones who pick up the intelligence. We're the ones who can actually help to make some of these policies work.
OK, so how are you actually able to help people in Henleys? Are you able to help them?
Helping people in Henleys, I would say that we are actually a very, very fortunate ward. Nevertheless, we still have council tax
quite well off
concerns. We tend to be reasonably well off, yes. And on the whole, people live healthy lives and they live long lives. But there is still quite problems there. So we help with council tax. We help the community in trying to get things done. We spent a lot of time over the summer trying to save a bus service because I think that it's wrong within a city that in fact there can be social isolation because people can't actually get to the hospitals and they can't get to their banks and they can't get to their shops. So it is issues like that. At the moment, we seem to be banging on about trees in order to make our particular ward and more generally the city a nice place to live.
back to your membership, the Liberal Democrat Party. I think most people understand that Conservatives tend to be more sort of business-minded for wealthier people. The Labour seem to push for either unemployed, disabled, working, poor, that sort of thing. It's a very great broad generalisation. What do the Lib Dems stand for? Who are you rooting for?
Well, it's an enormous generalisation, and I think it could be challenged on a lot of different levels, to be honest. I mean, what we are saying, if you want it very quickly and shortly, is that we're working for a stronger economy. I mean, let's face it, in 2010, it was in the most appalling state. So we're working for a stronger economy. We are working for a fairer society. And if you look at the way in which we have started in a big way, actually, to rebalance the tax situation from Mrs. Thatcher's trickle-down economics. And we are also working to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to get on.
But the society's not fairer since 2010, is it? Because there was a survey just recently that said actually this is since 2008, and the bulk of that has happened since the coalition came in, is that most of the working poor, that is to say people who are having a bit of trouble paying their bills but are in work and often on benefits too, they are £5,000 a year worse off than they were in 2008. So what you've got is a large slice of society at the bottom end who are already struggling even more, many of them actually going into debt because their work is not paying them enough.
Well, we have actually increased the tax allowance on the lower paid.
These are people who wouldn't have been paying tax anyway.
Oh, well, they would have been, actually. And don't forget that under Labour, Gordon Brown actually removed the 10% tax rate on the lowest paid and increased it to a 20% tax rate, the standard tax rate. So I think this perception that Labour automatically have an instinct for protecting poor people, I don't think the facts actually bear it out. I think the other issue is we know perfectly well that we have been under extreme pressure economically. I mean, even with reducing the deficit, we are now actually paying £53 million in interest payments, and that's more than we're actually spending on schools. So there are huge issues to be addressed. Some of it is legacy from where we were beforehand, and we recognise that the job is by no means done, and there's an awful lot to be done that's still further. But nevertheless, if you lift the working poor out of paying tax, that is a big benefit to them. We've also given families free school meals for their infants, and free childcare as well. So all these things actually help living standards, but we do have to recognise that wages have not been able to keep pace with inflation, even though on the whole inflation has been relatively low. But then is it going to be fair to pass on a huge credit card bill, which is what that deficit is, to the next generation? I don't think it is.
But is it fair that the wealthy have done quite well out of all this financial crisis? Actually, they've seen their stocks and shares going up reasonably well. Investments, for example, in their homes, if they own their own homes, chugging up gently, slowly up. And this isn't really fair, is it? The mayor is also a millionaire, he says. How do you think he's done as a mayor? Obviously, he's an ex-Liberal. Do you think that you actually support what he's been doing?
Can I just come back and say that actually, we are collecting, the government is actually collecting far more from tax loopholes, closing tax loopholes, than they ever did under the previous administration. So there is a real attempt to start to rebalance it. And millionaires will now be paying 350,000, I think that's about the right number, £350,000 more in tax under this government in the 4 years than they would have done previously. So, but the stocks and shares, I agree, is a problem. The property market is a problem, and it is partly the fact that we simply don't have enough houses, which is something that really does need to be addressed. I think you were going to ask about the mayor.
Yeah.
Right.
How do you think he's doing?
Well, that's an interesting question, really. And it's one which I don't feel I can answer in a very balanced sort of way, because we did campaign against an elected mayor. We campaigned because we felt that it was far too much power put into the hands of one person, whoever that person was.
Well, do you feel vindicated?
I think we do, yes.
Well, let's have a listen to Mayor Ferguson now, and here's a short extract from the One Love Breakfast earlier on this week, when George Ferguson was interviewed by our One Love Breakfast presenter and station manager Pat Hart. And here he is talking about his membership of the Merchant Venturers. He left the Merchant Venturers when he was elected mayor, but the Merchant Venturers, of course, are this historic organisation, a chartered organisation, and they are extremely wealthy. They've got a headquarters up on the promenade on Clifton Downs. And George talks about how he left membership when he became mayor.
I resigned, but the Merchant Venturers are an organisation that has a pretty dodgy history in terms of its some of its past, and certainly its connection with slavery. But it turned itself around in this century and the last to being one that gives back to Bristol, and they are generally successful business people, but also leaders in education and other areas of public service. And I wasn't there because I was a rich man, because I'm not, whatever anybody thinks, but because I'm somebody who tries to make this a better city, and that's what they do. They're putting loads and loads into education, into care for the elderly and other areas. So I know that Conspiracy Tony likes to have a go at them, conspiracy theorist Tony Gosling, but the fact is there's nothing secretive about it, and they are putting loads of good causes into the city for no other reason that they believe in the city.
So in many ways then, from what you've just said, and I've got to stand for Tony Gosling on our politics show, and I'm not going to repeat, you know, he's
no,
got his
well,
own...
Tony and I have sure. lively conversations sure. about it, and he loves okay. to, you know, he drags this up all sure. the time. It's old right. news, and it's not...
But
you know,
what I'm saying
really
is
relevant.
From what you're saying in terms of being formerly a merchant venturer, still very close and in contact with these people. So would that mean, apart from officially being a member of them, are you still involved? You still meet with them? Are there people that have a plan for Bristol that you share? And, you know, your critics will say, well, he's in the pockets of the merchant venturers. People like John Savage and others, people will always have comments to say, well, George is actually working with them. He's officially resigned, but really... he's one of them.
No, but if the Merchant Venturers didn't exist, I'd be bumping into these same people, because they are the people who...
Do you meet with them?
They are people who are movers and shakers in the city. You take John Savage as an example. He's somebody who's done a tremendous amount of good for the city. I don't think anybody could find any damage he's done to the city. He's been a visionary guy who's worked to bring business and public service together in the city in a way that's been really good for it. So I think it's such an easy thing to knock, and you know, and if I didn't have the courage to defend them, it would be an easy thing for me just to join the knocking. But sure. I don't think that would be fair, because generally they are good people. But I don't meet them any more than anybody else that plays
right.
a part in this city.
No, you've answered that.
And
but
I really admire people who are prepared to be active citizens. That's
George,
what I'm looking for. Is people
I've got to ask the
citizens.
Questions. I've got yeah. to ask the yeah. questions. That's,
yeah.
I would say that's what I'm paid to do.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a volunteer. It's community radio.
But I mean, I love Tony. He's hilarious, but he's also, you know, he loves to come up with any conspiracy that's on the planet.
That's nice to think that George loves me, and I certainly don't come up with every conspiracy on the planet. I like to actually make a difference between what I think is worth investigating, and there is all sorts of nonsense out there as well. And that's my job, really, to try and sort the two. And also, I suppose, to draw a line between fact and speculation. But Claire Campion-Smith, you're joining us as a guest on the Politics Show from Henleys. You're a Lib Dem. What are your thoughts about the influence today of the Merchant Venturers? It's an enormously wealthy, very old organisation. And actually, he says it's not secretive, but actually there are some members who do not appear on their website. I found out recently that somebody called Edward Ware, who's a director of Bristol Rovers and a housing developer, he's a merchant venturer, but he wasn't on their website. It was just a dogged local campaigner that actually managed to find out that he was a merchant venturer. So there is a little bit of reluctance for them to be completely open about what they do.
Well, I'd probably be a bit on the side of the conspiracy theorists, actually, because I think one of the things that is a bit worrying with the movement towards the mayor, the movement towards the police commissioner and so on, and the fact that the local enterprise partnership is actually run by a merchant venturer, and that in fact, although it does have council leaders on it, I'm not sure that the level of public accountability is strong enough. So I think there is a movement at the moment towards the self-defined great and good trying to rule the city. Now, I think we ought to be careful because the reality is that a lot of these people have done a tremendous amount. And I look at somewhere like the Merchants Academy out at Withywood, and I look at the commitment that they put into it, both personal and financial as well. And it would be very sad if we didn't have that sort of commitment to the city. But I do think we've got to be very, very careful that we're not moving to a stage where ordinary councillors who represent their local communities are being sidelined and people who've got the power, the influence, are taking over. It has got to be a level partnership, or preferably one slightly in the favour of the councillors, I would say. I think one of the things which councillors have had a very bad press with, particularly under this mayor, is he keeps accusing us of doing party politics. Now, I think that we have got to fight that particular argument, because the reality is that parties have enabled a wide range of people to become selected and to become councillors. You don't have to be rich in order to be selected and elected. So I think that's very important. And when we had a large party on the city council, we actually represented the most affluent ward, or one of the most affluent wards, which was my ward. We also represented one of the very poorest wards. Now, where the strength of that is that as a party, we could look at policies and we could try and work out how it would impact on all the different parts of the city. So that is a real strength of a political party. The mayor accuses us of playing party politics. Well, we do sometimes, I have to confess that. But the reality is we're not clones. We do have different perspectives. But within a party, you should have the arguments about what is best for the city. I should really say debates about what's best for the city. And also we should all bring our different experiences so that we get a whole city approach. So that's just my little bandwagon, really, that I've banged on about.
I wonder if it'd be interesting to see if the mayor might put somebody who wasn't a wealthy merchant venturer in charge of something like the local enterprise partnership. Problem with that, of course, is the meetings are closed to the public. There is really no accountability there. Lines of accountability are very clouded. I mean, you know, there's vast amounts of property, for example, the local enterprise partnership is looking at, which is public property, but the public is shut out. Martin, what about the argument that George is using there, that the merchants are putting into the city? Because many people look at it and say, well, actually, the poor are doing very badly. The rich, like the merchants, are doing very well.
Well, that's a wider point, isn't it? The merchant venturers aren't going to go away, are they? I mean, the fact of the matter is they exist. And politics is about interests and the representation of interests.
But we just heard from Claire there that they seem to be taking a bigger role in the city.
Well, the real problem in our society as a whole is that we haven't got a proper democracy. We've got a plutocracy, oligarchy, and it's becoming more like that. I mean, the crisis, because of quantitative easing, what's effectively happened is the state has intervened to protect the asset values of the asset rich. And if you'd followed a free market policy as represented by the von Mises Institute, for example, you wouldn't, no quantitative easing, no bailing out of the banks, then the wealthy classes would have lost an awful lot of money. And the fact that the policy has been pursued to, and that it was a Labour policy to begin with and then became a coalition policy to bail out the asset rich, that what you've actually got from an economics point of view is that once you've made that decision, you've given up on the idea of having a free market. Now, I don't believe in a free market. I'm a socialist, so it doesn't matter to me. But it's for those who do believe in a free market, you've got to accept that from 2008 onwards, the allocation of resources is no longer a free market allocation. It's a political allocation. And a political decision has been made to make the wealthy, keep the wealthy's assets not just stable, but actually increasing, and the burden of adjustment has been pushed onto the poorest, particularly the disabled.
What about the former master of the merchants, John Savage? George is talking about there. He's a Labour Party member, isn't he? And he stood as the Police and Crime Commissioner for Labour. He's been one of these people, as George was saying, who's been instrumental in these partnerships, public-private partnership type things, where you've got a large budget, half of which or so is funded publicly and half privately. How has this actually affected things? Has this meant actually that big business is now having more and more of a say in how public money is being spent?
Well, the private finance initiative, if you remember, it was originally a Conservative policy and it was enthusiastically adopted by New Labour. And in fact, of course, this is not the way to, in my view, the way to fund
public services. I'm talking about things like local enterprise partnership, where you've got councillors sitting in parallel with local business leaders deciding how public money is going to be spent.
Well, exactly. I mean, of course, they replaced the previous regional development authorities, which were the Labour version of the same thing. And ultimately, of course, basically what has happened in our society and across the Western world is that the plutocracy have retained and expanded their power as a result of the crisis. And of course, this is all going to come to an end. Quantitative easing ended in the United States this week, or at least in theory it did. And there's every possibility that this is all going to crash, because you can bail it out forever, but eventually it goes. And of course, none of the party leaders on any of the major parties are telling people what they need to hear, which is actually the situation is as bad and worse. The derivatives market is now bigger than it was in 2008, and there's every possibility of another major crash. And then, of course, the political class will be swept away in a tsunami.
Well, let's have a listen now to another shorter clip here from the interview with Mayor George Ferguson. This is about the notorious resident parking zones and the fact that it doesn't look like the disabled people with blue badges are going to be allowed to park in these resident parking zones, which just seems to me an appalling decision. So let's hear what the Mayor had to say on Pat Hart's One Love Breakfast show about that.
This whole thing about blue badge holders has been a storm in a teacup, because when I talk to blue badge holders, the actual operation is quite different. Their actual experience is very different to the PR that's been put out by the people who are basically anti-residence parking and using it as a whip to thrash me with. And of course it's effective, because we care deeply about disabled. I'm extremely lucky as an ex-polio victim to not be in a wheelchair myself, and I take a real exception to those who think that I don't care about that. I care deeply about it, and I think about access all the time.
But
the
George,
fact is, we are monitoring it, but the experience so far is that blue badge holders are not being disadvantaged.
Okay, well, we've got blue badge holders that are saying that they are. In places like London, blue badge holders can park, including in the residence areas.
Only in one or two of the boroughs in London.
Yeah. And no, more than one or two. George?
No, you're absolutely wrong. All we right. are absolutely in line with the national recommendations.
So are they going to be clamping disabled people who are, or just fining them? I'm not sure. We shall see. Anyway, Claire, what's your experience with resident parking zone? I know you haven't got one up in Henley's, but what's your thought about generally the way it's been introduced?
Well, it was appalling, to be honest. And I think they thought they were doing it terribly well. We were invited to a meeting. We pointed out that, in fact, a 2 weeks consultation period, which went over half term, was not going to produce the right sort of result. So they ignored a lot of the consultation processes which have been put in place. And consequently, people were up in arms. It is a very emotive subject. I think you've got to accept that. And it's like a lot of these emotive subjects. If, in fact, you ask people what they think, if you listen to what they think, if you're prepared to adjust, and if at the end of the day you have to tell people that you can't satisfy all their needs, they tend to be happy that at least they have been heard. And the difficulty was the consultation was very, very poor. Some of the ideas they put forward were poor. They didn't respond to residents' comments. So all in all, I think one could best describe it as a bit of a shambles, which it need not necessarily have been.
And what about the blue badge, the disabled parking? Because that surely is, you know, it's a basic thing. We should not be penalising disabled people who need to park near their relatives, near their friends when they're visiting them.
Yes, I have to say that because we don't have residence parking zones, I'm not that up to speed on this particular issue. But I think the point is that these sort of things should be helping residents as much as possible. It does seem at the moment that this particular policy is penalising them.
Well, it's certainly penalising the poorer parts of the city, isn't it? I mean, places like St Paul's, people cannot fork out, squids it costs for one of these parking tickets for residents parking. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this particular issue of the blue badges and resident parking more generally?
Well, I think George Ferguson has been very brave in pushing forward this. I mean, there clearly are issues with public transport and all the rest of it, and he's nailed his colours to the mast on this, and he said that's what he was going to do in the election campaign. So, in a sense, he's carried through on it. I think the real problem is do you remember when John Prescott talked about having a joined up transport policy back in the day when New Labour were in power? What happened to that? And what happened to that is when New Labour were in power, the same interest groups, the road lobby, etc., the oil industry, dominated the debate as they always do. And attempts to go against that are always going to run against the grain. I think when we've had George on here, I've said that if you go to Gloucester, the centre of Gloucester has been entirely pedestrianised, which I think is it's very attractive, because you can walk around the whole city and see the medieval city as it must have looked to the medieval population. And as a sort of history buff, I find that really exciting. But on the other hand, of course, it caused enormous rows, because lots of businesses that depended upon having cars coming into the centre of the city had to go. And I'm afraid when you make big changes, some people lose out and they scream and shout.
Now, one thing that did make me laugh, though, about the interview with George Ferguson was when he said that the Evening Post weren't supporting him. There's another article in the Evening Post this week saying 3 out of 4 people in Bristol say the elected mayor gives visible leadership. And this, of course, is a survey conducted by some of the city elite institutions. So there you go. And, of course, I think everybody knows that the Bristol Post do support the mayor. And they, in fact, in his campaign, they were having lots of puff pieces about him. Anyway, on to a national story. Punitive drug law enforcement is failing, says the Home Office study. This is in The Guardian yesterday. There's no evidence that tough enforcement of drug laws on personal possession leads to lower levels of drug use, according to UK government's first evidence-based study examining international drug laws. The groundbreaking Home Office document brings to an end 40 years of almost unbroken official political rhetoric that only harsher penalties can tackle the problem caused by the likes of heroin, cocaine or cannabis. It's signed off by the Conservative Home Secretary Theresa May and the Lib Dem Minister Norman Baker, and will be published alongside an official expert report calling for a general ban on the sale and trade in legal highs. Claire, what's your thoughts about this? Because there's been quite a storm about this week, with most of the Conservatives really splitting from the Lib Dems and saying, despite what Theresa May signing this report off, saying it's a load of nonsense.
Right. Well, I think there are two things, actually. I mean, the first thing is that the organised crime, the gangs who are selling the drugs, importing them into the country, then we crack down on those as hard as we possibly can, and we disrupt their activity. So I think that's the first thing to be said. But the thing that actually this focuses on is the people who are in possession of small quantities of drugs for their own personal use. Now, what has been found when they've looked at studies from different countries is that actually whether you've got soft laws or whether you've got hard laws on personal use, it doesn't seem to make much difference to the take-up of that. So it's obviously not acting as a deterrent to have a tough law. What they have found, though, is that if you treat these people from the health perspective, then in fact you get much, much better outcomes for people reducing their drug use and for their own personal health. So when it comes to people in possession of a small amount of drugs for their personal use, then we believe, and the evidence supports that in fact they should be that sort of work should be transferred to the health department and away from the Home Office.
Martin, can get your take on this, because what they're essentially saying is that it's a bit like prohibition in the US back in the last century, is that actually what's happened is it's created this massive criminal market, and it's not going away.
Well, that's right. I mean, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime produced the report in 2009, and it's staffed mainly by police officers from around the world, and they said, well, when the banks were wobbling in 2008, the drug cartels basically washed all of their dirty money in one fell swoop through the banking system, and there was such a large amount of money involved that it probably was decisive in preventing a banking crash. That's how big the international drugs market is. And in countries like Colombia and Mexico, if we remember the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s, where the CIA were bringing large amounts of cocaine into the United States, I don't think there's any doubt about that's what they were doing. And I think the real problem with there are health issues with drugs, but the real problem with drugs is the money, the dirty money, which buys politics in places like Colombia. And of course, the CIA have been heavily implicated in this over the years. But if we're talking about just taking baby steps in the right direction, and I welcome the Liberals' position on this, because they've taken what I regard as a sensible adult attitude, unlike some of the Conservative backbenchers. If you look at Portugal, they decided to decriminalise personal possession about 15, 20 years ago, and all the stats show that their stats are much better than other places. And of course, it's actually a cultural thing. If you look at the stats about who takes drugs where, Britain takes more drugs than anybody else in Europe, even though we've got some of the harshest laws, because that's the British for you. There's two fingers up to the government. The other place is Denmark, is about half the level we are. But the United States has double the amount of people taking drugs in Britain, and they've got the harshest laws of all. And of course, if you live in a harsh society where there's no benefits and no jobs, and people robbing liquor stores at gunpoint, then worrying about what your drug intake is doesn't really matter too much if you're on the bottom of the pile, does it?
Well, talking of which, crisis, undercover report is revealing that councils now fob most desperate homeless off with nothing. This is the crisis, the charity. Even in the 21st century, homeless people who ask their council for help are being turned away to sleep on the streets, cold, desperate and forgotten. This is nothing short of a scandal. No one turned away is the name of the campaign, and they've been investigating the scale of the problem. Crisis recently sent undercover researchers to 16 councils across England to test the support that is offered to homeless people. In 50 out of 87 council, the mystery shoppers that went in saying that their conditions were they had nowhere to sleep that night received little or no help at all. What's the situation here in Bristol like, Claire?
Well, I suppose we always hope that it's not as bad as that. However, I do sometimes wonder, because so often a response from a council can depend upon the individual person that they meet, which is not good. We know that our public services are under a lot of stress, and the reality is that the more effective you are at that very, very first point of contact, the more you can solve a person's problem, then the cheaper it actually is for public services, the better it is for the individual as well. So, I mean, I hope that we are responding very well to that first point of contact and giving people support. We do know that a lot of the homeless people have got a mental health problem. And I think one
wouldn't
of the
Wouldn't you have?
Pardon?
Wouldn't you have if you got nowhere to sleep?
Absolutely. Yes, yes. But sometimes it's a cause of them being homeless as well. So it's a mixture of the two.
Well, maybe the council's also a cause of it. I mean, you know, you've got a really serious problem here. There are the sorts of conditions which people are left to survive in Bristol City Centre. If someone was looking after an animal, the RSPCA would probably prosecute them for not feeding, not giving them somewhere to sleep, this kind of thing. And it just seems an incredibly cruel attitude to a lot of homeless people.
Well, I don't know that it is. I don't know what evidence you're producing that there are people.
Well, I know that we've had a more than doubling in the number of street sleepers, for example, in the city in the last year.
But in fact, council officers and working with voluntary sector do go round, and they do try and get those people into proper accommodation. We do have policies and actions which will try and provide the right sort of accommodation and the right sort of supported accommodation for these people. And it is one of those issues where you have got to keep on trying to do the very best that you can for them. And the other thing is, though, that I think that one of the contributory factors quite often is mental health in the first place. And if we could support people at that point, if we could make our own officers, the police and so on, more alert and aware of mental problems, then I think quite often it's a question of being able to solve the problem at an earlier stage and before it gets too acute.
Well, Barry Shearman, the MP, brought this up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week, so here he is.
Mr. Barry Shearman.
Mr. Speaker, I am sure that the Prime Minister cares about families, and particularly families under stress, under great stress.
Yeah.
But is he aware that up and down our country, there are stressed families with a challenged or challenging child that cannot obtain any help from mental health services? And in two-thirds of our country, research that I have conducted shows that the access is not there, not in 3 months, not in 6 months, not in a year. What can we together do something to stop this dreadful system?
Now, I do agree with the Honourable Gentleman about the importance of mental health services. We have taken some important steps forward, for instance giving parity of esteem with mental health in the NHS constitution, and recently announced additional money and additional waiting time targets for mental health services. And we all know from our constituency surgeries how many people are in need of these services that may actually help them and prevent there being further pressures on the NHS if those services are given.
Yes, Claire. So there he is talking about exactly what you were talking about, lack of mental health care. And that was Barry Shearman, who's Labour MP for Huddersfield.
I think there has got to be a concern about mental health, and we haven't commissioned it very well in the past in Bristol. We know that there have been gaps in the particular service. I sit on the corporate parenting panel, so I think the service for young people has improved quite considerably, with people having access to it far more quickly. But this is one of those issues where I think all parties are in agreement that mental health is a serious problem, and we have got to put more resources into it, and we've got to reduce the stigma of it. And in fact, at the next full council, I will be proposing a motion about mental health.
Martin, it does seem that slowly but surely all of these public services are slowly being cut. Since 2008, the crisis, the bailout, almost all of the money that we're paying in tax, far greater amounts of it are going in paying interest on that massive debt. They're just basically slowly but surely taking away all these public services. Mental health is just the latest.
Well, you could argue, I mean, this brings us back to the question of whether austerity is a good or a bad idea. And, of course, in actual fact, what's happened as the election has got closer...
Well, surely nobody thinks it's a good idea, do they?
Well, yeah, some people do see it as an opportunity to remake the compact between the state and society in a more neoliberal direction. There's certainly people in the Conservative Party who see it as an opportunity rather than a problem, austerity. But, of course, what's actually happened, if you look at what Osborne's policy has been, in the first 2 years of the coalition, he slammed the brakes on because we've got to try and get the deficit down, supposedly, by making sure that benefits are cut and so forth. And, of course, the economy stalled. And at that point, he took his foot off the brake as the election came closer. And we've got some growth back in the economy now, but at the same time, the deficit is creeping up again. And I would argue, as an ex-teacher of economics, that those two things are not entirely unrelated. In other words, Osborne has effectively done what Balls was telling him to do all along, which was to go steady on the austerity. But of course, the fundamental problem is you bail out the banking system, as we have done. And as Milton Friedman pointed out, the problem with this is they keep coming back for more. If you bail out a steel industry, they'll keep coming back for more. The current financial services industry is completely not fit for purpose. And when you bailed them out in 2008, they should have been given a massive, massive kicking. But they've not been given any kind
of
kicking.
But we own Lloyds, don't we? I thought we owned it, and RBS. Surely we can just tell them what to
do. The Labour government bent over backwards not to nationalise these banks. So they chucked money at them and said, we're not going to nationalise them. Oh, no, we're not using that naughty N-word. And of course, what we really probably will have to do in the end, after we've had another crash, because that's what it will take, is we're going to have to have a publicly run banking system. The model probably is the Bank of North Dakota in the US, which has been run by the state of North Dakota since 1919. And they are the only state in the union which is solvent, because they've got a public bank which backs the local government.
Okay.
So can I just make a comment about that? Because what you actually said about the government bailing out the banks and so on, you might be putting forward an economics point of view, which is fair enough. But for many people who had their personal savings in banks and would also have been seriously affected by it as well, that's the sort of impetus that makes politicians possibly make different decisions than purely economic ones.
Well, can I just say on that point, that you can preserve the depositors of banks. That's okay. I mean, the federal deposit insurance has existed since the 1930s in the US, but the shareholders of the banks, they should be burned completely.
Right, but some
have you got
of,
shares
some
in
ordinary,
a bank, Claire?
Yes, we do actually. My husband has got shares in Royal Bank of Scotland, which were given to him by his mother when she died. They're not a big set of shares.
But the point is, if you're going to fill a free market policy, the wealthy have to lose their money when casino capitalism crashes. And if they don't, then you've got to have it. We're no longer in Kansas anymore. We're in a bailout the wealthy classes.
Well, my understanding is that, in fact, I mean, you said quite clearly that, in fact, nothing has happened to the banks. My understanding is that they have separated out what they call the casino banks from the straightforward high street
banks.
Well,
no, there was a decision by the Select Committee, Andrew Tyrese. Treasury Select Committee that this was going to happen, but it hasn't actually happened yet. There is still no separation between casino banking.
They've got lobbying power, so this has been suggested. Andrew Tyrese's report, which I thought was pretty good.
Right.
But what happened, it was watered down as soon as it came to implementation. You can imagine the lobbying power these organisations have. They've got people sitting on the committee marking one-to-one the people who are doing the decisions.
Yeah, and it's very difficult actually being a politician in those
They're going to be right on your case,
aren't
they?
You're right. And I think that one of the difficulties, well, one of the things which would actually help politicians sometimes would be if the people actually said, yes, you know, we want you to do this, so get on with it.
Yeah, but there wasn't. The Labour government was completely caught with its pants down by the crisis.
Yeah.
As a, you know, Marxist left Keynesian economist, they should have seen that coming a mile off.
Okay, can we talk now about some of the consequences of all this austerity? Grandad shoots himself after finding out his benefits were being stopped. This is in the Mirror earlier this year, and it's a story that I'd missed. Sean Pilkington, 58, was sent a letter saying he was to lose his employment and support allowance, which he got after a long-term illness. A grandad who just found out his benefits were being stopped shot himself dead after telling friends he was unable to cope. He was 58 years old, and he was sent a letter saying he was to lose his employment and support allowance. Another story, much more recent, that's yesterday in The Guardian. Patrick Wintour, benefit sanctions regime for the unemployed is to be investigated by MPs. There were various reasons, a whole litany of horrific cases, one of which, Claire, where someone was sanctioned, had no money to pay for electricity, and their fridge where they kept their insulin, there was no electricity, and he died.
Yep, and that is an appalling case, and nobody, I don't think, would ever...
He was an ex-soldier, actually.
Yep. I don't think anybody would ever wish that to happen or would actually defend that particular happening.
It was nice to see, though, 211,000 people signed a petition started by Jill Thompson after her diabetic brother, David Clapson, 59, was found dead in his home after he ran out of electricity.
Mm. Yes. It's very difficult for me to be able to comment on individual cases like that because I don't know what the circumstances were behind it. Of course, we want to support people who are in particularly difficult situations. My understanding is that the people who were running the disability things for the government have had their contracts stopped. Because of the very, very poor way in which they were doing it and the inhumane way in which they were doing it. I'm glad that that has been stopped and some of it is actually being brought back into the government, so I hope that that will be a better system.
But on principle,
so I'm not
do you think that people who
that.
Need insulin to live should have their electricity bills paid?
No, they shouldn't. And I don't know how it happened. I mean, I don't know whether the information didn't go to the right people or whatever it might be.
But he had his job seeker's allowance stopped and he had no money for electricity.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of these sanctions, I think there's been nearly a million of them now, are very often one on appeal, Martin, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I think this is the problem.
I was only going to say that, I mean, one of the things which has exercised people a lot is the under-occupancy charge.
The bedroom tax.
The under-occupancy charge, yes, the bedroom tax. Now, that what we have done as a local authority, and this is where localism does help, is that we have made it absolutely clear, and we called in the mayor's decision, that in fact nobody should lose any money if we couldn't offer them another property that was appropriate and suitable. So it's those sort of things where you can mitigate and make sure that local people's voices are heard.
Just one little thing I'd like to say before we have the next story is that we've been talking quite a lot about the merchant venturers. I love talking about them because I'd like to know very much more than I do know about them. Seems to be quite difficult to find out. I actually phoned them today and invited them on this programme. So hopefully the new master of the merchants, or the old master, they're having some sort of a ceremony in a couple of weeks where the new master of the merchant venturers takes over from the old one. So hopefully we'll be able to have a chat with them. I can ask them some, grill them if you want, and they can explain how they have no connections with slavery whatsoever anymore. Anyway, the number of global billionaires has doubled since the financial crisis. This is Oxfam Wednesday this week. The number of billionaires has doubled since the start of the financial crisis, according to a major new report from anti-poverty campaigners. The world's rich are getting richer, leaving hundreds of millions of people facing a life trapped in poverty as global inequality spirals out of control. The report found that the number of billionaires has more than doubled to 1,646 since the financial crisis, Martin, of 2008.
Well, this is the result of quantitative easing. This is what people don't realise. The decision by the US and the British government and the European governments to bail out the financial sector has led to a situation where the wealthy, the asset rich, have not just preserved their wealth, they've actually increased their wealth. And the books are being balanced, if they are being balanced, and of course they're not really being balanced, on the backs of the most vulnerable. And coming back to this question of sanctions and benefits, there's clearly a strategy by Linton Crosby and those advising the Conservative government. They look at their focus groups, and it's a winner. When you go out there and say people on benefits are lazy, work shy, this, that, and the other, and the swing marginal constituencies, which they have to win, the very small, you know, the swing voters in Basildon, etc. They like to hear that. And Crosby's strategy is to bang on them. He wants the poor to be seen to be punished because the people in the swing marginals may. That's what they want to hear. But the problem for the Conservatives is this: that the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Trussell Trust and the Church of England, for example, are absolutely opposed, because it's quite deliberate policy for the poor to be punished.
Now, can I say that the
Church of England is not going to accept it?
Yep, and can I say that the Liberal Democrats are equally opposed to this? And
you were talking about fairness earlier on,
yep,
Claire, weren't
we
you?
Have consistently,
this is not fair, is it?
We have consistently distanced ourselves from when Conservatives talk about shirkers and so on, because that isn't the case. And I think that one of the things which we have got to attempt to do is to make sure that people have got the skills to be able to get into work and to be able to have the jobs to do it. And it is hard going.
This thing of shirkers is nothing new, though. I remember reading about enclosures. This is people being evicted from the land. Well, historically, they were being blamed. This is hundreds of years ago, saying, well, yep, these country people, they don't work hard enough. We need to evict them from the land and then force them into factories.
If you read your Dickens, all of these attitudes are there. And of course, from the political point of view, the Conservative spin doctors think, right, if we beat up on these social groups, this is a winner for us. It's in the swing marginals that we need to win. Of course, if we had PR, it would be a different story, because everybody's voice would be heard.
Yeah.
Anyway, Martin mentioned the church. Yeah. Pope Francis says caring for the poor does not make you a communist. He made the comments in one of his longest speeches as Pope. He must have got an umbrage being accused of being a commie. Pope Francis has once again rejected claims his concern for the poor and criticism of capitalism make him a communist by declaring he's merely following the gospel. In one of his longest speeches as Pope, the Holy See outlined his views on a wide range of issues, from poverty and the injustices of unemployment to the need to protect the environment. Today, he said, I want to unite my voice with yours and accompany you in your fight, he said to participants of the World Meeting of Popular Movements, which is holding a three-day conference in Rome involving groups including trade unions, peasant farmers, gosh, there we go, look, we're peasant farmers again, and domestic workers. We don't have a lot of peasants left in Britain now, though, do we? Anyway, Claire, what do you thoughts about the Pope there? Is a communist? The funny old thing is, a lot of communists were attacked, weren't they, because they wanted to take some of these big industries off big families that had had them for centuries, and they were hated for that.
Yes, they were. And actually, the church has got a very good record, especially in Latin America and places like that, for standing up for the poor. And they were blamed as being communists, when in fact they were tackling some of these issues. I think Pope Francis is a real breath of fresh air, and I think he's good, and I think he's articulating ideas and thoughts that we need to be taking on board.
Martin, the address came after a right-wing US commentator said the Pope is a Marxist because he criticised capitalist excess, demanded the governments should redistribute social benefits to the needy.
Well, I mean, the church has actually rather ambivalent views on liberation theology. I think this particular pope, in fact, was a very centrist, not particularly during the military dictatorship. He was regarded to some extent as complicit. But having worked for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development in the past, I'm very aware of the Catholic Church's heroic role in Latin America.
Yeah,
people like Oscar Romero were shot dead by the right-wing paramilitaries in El Salvador as he celebrated mass. Right-wing paramilitaries paid for by US taxpayer money, of course, as they were flooding the US with the drugs we were talking about earlier to pay for their terrorist campaign against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. The West is run by a wicked oligarchy, a criminal oligarchy, and the Pope is beginning to question that, and that's good.
There's two stories together here. Giant bank crash scenario practiced by UK and US regulators, which George Osborne was involved in, and also Federal Reserve is to end its quantitative easing programme. This week it's ending quantitative easing. Martin, is there any coincidence that they're crash testing just as they're ending quantitative easing?
Yes, because I'm quite sure that the senior civil servants at the Bank of England are very well aware that there's every possibility of a major crash here. And if there is a major crash before the next election, I think the political class in the West will be all driven out. It won't be UKIP we'll have to worry about. It'll be much worse than that.
Claire, coincidence that they're testing out to see if there's going to be another enormous crash at the same time as the Americans are switching off the quantitative easing tap?
Wow. I have to say that I, as a local councillor, I don't involve myself in quite the same extent with
parliamentary candidates as well, which you haven't
with these eager things, and I will have to get to grips with these sort of things. It is very worrying because I think there are an awful lot of things which are on a knife edge. I think our civilization is on a knife edge. Our political freedoms are on a knife edge. And once we stop fighting for those sort of things, then it will be very easy for them to be swept away. And I think it will be very, very... Well, it would be very worrying for an awful lot of people if anything like this actually happened. And what I find difficult, really, about the whole of politics is we talk about what's happening in the States.
Very quick, you've got one sentence.
Okay,
quick.
But the average American who goes about their daily lives, like the average British person going about their daily lives, just wants some fairly basic things in life, and it's how we actually deliver that.
Well, it'd be nice if we could trust our politicians. The only trouble is, of course, George Osborne said he was going to explain what the results of it was, and he hasn't. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. After the news, Lockerbie.
Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Fiona Wolfe has resigned as the head of the inquiry into historical child sex abuse after criticism from victims' representatives. They claim she was unsuitable for the role because of her links to Lord Britain, who is expected to be called to give evidence. Mrs. Wolfe says she stepped aside to make sure the victims' voices are heard.
I was determined that the inquiry got to the bottom of the issues for them, and if I don't command their confidence to run the panel fairly and impartially, then I need to get out of the way.
The Home Secretary says she's accepted Mrs. Wolfe's resignation and will make a common statement on Monday.